It's April 13th, 1973, and a most unusual ship has begun its maiden voyage from Sun Shipbuilding and Dry Dock in Chester, Pennsylvania, down the Delaware River to the Atlantic Ocean. The ship is jaw-droppingly large, 200 meters long, about the size of a battleship. It has a huge tower and derrick on the top that look a little like a cross between a kid's Erector set and a mini Eiffel Tower. The midsection of the ship contains an enormous hidden well that could be opened at the bottom. It was so big it could hold 7 Olympic-sized swimming pools and was called the Moon Pool, perhaps because it seemed big enough to swallow the moon itself. The ship, the Hughes Glomar Explorer, was built at the behest of the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes at a cost of more than $350 million. That's more than $2 billion in today's dollars. Hughes's widely publicized plan was to harvest mineral-rich manganese nodules from the Pacific seafloor at depths of nearly 5,000 meters. No one had ever done anything remotely like this before. Nevertheless, seabed minerals were in the collective consciousness. On August 1st, 1963, just months before he was assassinated, the U.S. President John F. Kennedy delivered this speech about the importance of the oceans.
Knowledge of the oceans is more than a matter of curiosity. Our very survival may hinge upon it. The seas offer a wealth of food for the people of the world. Mineral resources on land will ultimately reach their limits. We may be able to extract additional elements in the water. To predict, and perhaps someday to control, changes in weather and climate is of the utmost importance to man everywhere.
Hughes's announcement and the sailing of the Glomar Explorer even kick-started university offerings in the U.S. in ocean engineering. You could say that the age of seabed mining had been launched. Except the Glomar Explorer would never raise a single manganese nodule from the ocean floor. Instead, its highly secret mission was to raise a sunken Soviet sub, lost in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with all hands aboard, in nearly 5,000 meters of water. And while Hughes, a well-known patriot, lent his name to the endeavor, the covert operation to recover the sub was actually financed and operated by the CIA, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. I'm Nancy Basil-Chuck, and you're listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Today's podcast extra is a follow-up to an earlier episode about Norway's decision to open its seabed to exploration and mining. If you haven't listened to it yet, you'll find it in your feed. In the course of my reporting for that episode, I learned a lot of things I couldn't include in the story, like the weird secret tale of the Glomar Explorer. The real story of this ship, conceived in the heyday of the Cold War in the U.S., is an amazing story on its own. But it also says a lot about how society looks at resources from the ocean, both then and now.
To some extent, you can say it's a wild story about the eccentric billionaire who's recruited by the CIA to help retrieve a sunken Soviet submarine.
That's Mats Ingolstad, a historian at NTNU's Department of Modern History and Society. One of his research areas is the history of strategic metals and minerals. And he's as fascinated by the Glomar Explorer story as I am. And what a story this is. On February 25th, 1968, a Soviet submarine known as the K-129 left Kamchatka, on Russia's Pacific coast to head out on a 70-day mission in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands. On board were 98 men and three nuclear missiles, each with a 1 megaton warhead. To put that in perspective, 1 megaton is 65 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. Should war break out between the USSR and the US, the K-129 would have launched its three nuclear missiles at strategic targets on the US West Coast. The K-129 was scheduled to send a short message on March 8th, but nothing was heard. When the sub missed a second planned transmission, the Soviets began searching for their sub. Most visible to the Americans were the flights of Soviet reconnaissance aircraft, which flew nearly 300 missions over the area where their sub was thought to be lost. Documents about the whole affair describe the Soviets abandoning all pretense of secrecy and communicating without encryption as they worked, more and more desperately, to find the sub. After 2 months of searching, they gave up. They never found it, but the Americans did. And once they found it, the American military began trying to figure out a way to bring it up. Remember, the Cold War was in full swing, and the idea that the U.S. military could get its hands on Soviet nuclear warheads, or code books, or missile guidance systems, or anything that could tell them more about Soviet submarines and their nuclear capability. It was as irresistible as it was impossible. A 2,000-ton submarine under nearly 5,000 meters of water. Raising something like that? Nothing like it had ever been done before. Enter Howard Hughes. One of the many challenges of bringing a 2,000-ton submarine up from the depths of the Pacific Ocean was that there would be absolutely no way to hide what was being done. Or was there? Once the CIA got the go-ahead, they came up with an idea. Instead of hiding what they were doing, they'd come up with a plausible story and do their work in full view of the world. Enter the secret plan, codenamed Project Azorian. The agency reached out to Howard Hughes to see if he would be willing to provide the cover story for Project Azorian. Hughes was a logical choice. He was known for making big, possibly risky investments that paid off. He also had a number of U.S. government contracts.
The way the story is sometimes told is that this is really the cover story that helps make deep sea mining look viable. Because if Howard Hughes is investing in it, it must be something that's possible.
But Mott said the CIA did a really good job of picking its cover story. It turns out that lots of companies really were interested in deep-sea mining, even without Hughes. A perfect way to hide something in plain sight.
The CIA is latching into something which increasingly is looking feasible. Because you have American companies, such as the Kennecott Corporation, which was a huge copper producer and was fearful of nationalization of its assets in Chile, for instance. They had been looking into deep-sea mining for several years. And another player was the Reynolds Metals Company, which had gotten into aluminium during the Second World War.
Mott said the Reynolds Metals Company had actually built a deep submersible out of aluminium called the Aluminaut, that it envisioned playing a useful role in deep-sea mining. So companies were already investing.
It has resonance because it speaks to the anticipation that this is something that can happen in the early 1970s. Of course, the CIA wouldn't have chosen a cover story that was totally implausible, because then it's of no use. It speaks to the enthusiasm and the expectation that deep-sea mining is about to happen. And that's been the case for many, many decades, that this is something that will happen eventually, and it is in the future. We have the technological capacity to do it.
Be that as it may, it would still take 4 years after the Soviet sub went missing before the CIA was able to send the ship, the Glomar Explorer, to where the sub had gone down, about 2,500 kilometers northwest of Hawaii. I guess they weren't really worried about anybody else raising it off the sea bottom. And this wasn't all construction time. No, 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 no. Part of this crazy story is what happened to the ship during its preparations before it actually even began its mission. For one thing, the ship was built on the east coast of the United States and had to sail to the west coast, where it could be fitted out with the special CIA spy equipment it would need for its mission. But the ship was far too big to pass through the Panama Canal. So, it had to sail roughly 20,000 kilometers south and west, around the tip of South America, and through the Straits of Magellan. The plan for the trip involved a stop in Valparaiso, in Chile, where the ship would get some new technicians, supplies, and a bag of personal mail. This, it would turn out, was a case of incredible bad timing. The Glomar Explorer was due to arrive in Chile on September 12, 1973. On September 11, 1973, a group of military officers led by General Augusto Pinochet seized power in a coup. The declassified CIA report describes the experience of the new crew waiting in Valparaiso like this. At approximately 1600 hours, the Americans were awakened by noise outside the hotel. It was evident that the revolution had started, as there were soldiers, tanks, armored cars, and other military vehicles. As attested in his trip report, which reads like a Hollywood script, Tom Williams, the Global Marine representative, encountered much intrigue and suspense in getting the seven technicians, supplies, and parts loaded on the Hughes Glomar Explorer in the midst of the revolution. I have tried my best to find Tom Williams's trip report, but to no avail. For this, we will just have to use our imagination. One observant reader of my script pointed out that, didn't the CIA have a little hand in this Pinochet coup? The CIA isn't saying. From there, it was relatively smooth sailing to Long Beach, California, where 24 vans containing classified equipment were loaded into the ship. And then off they went, arriving at the recovery site on July 4th, 1974. Due to the complicated nature of raising a 2,000-ton submarine up from more than 5,000 meters of water, it took nearly a month before they could actually lift the sub, and 8 days before they were able to bring it into the moon pool. There was a fair amount of excitement during the mission, including a visit by a Soviet ship with a helicopter on board. The declassified document that describes the whole project said the captain ordered the crew of the Glomar Explorer to load boxes on the Explorer's helipad to prevent the Soviet helicopter from making a surprise landing. It did, however, make many, many passes over the ship, no doubt taking pictures, but the cover story held. The declassified document I've used for much of this story doesn't say how much of the sub they were able to recover in the end, but subsequent reporting suggests the sub broke apart on its way up from the depths.
And it turns out it's more difficult than assumed to operate at great depths, and so they lose half the sub on the way up.
We might have never learned about this strange story had it not been for some enterprising reporting by national journalists, including Seymour Hersh, who would later go on to win the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Vietnam War. And what first tipped journalists off was a 1974 burglary. For U.S. political history fans, this is a little ironic. U.S. President Richard Nixon was famously forced to resign in August 1974, in part because of a different burglary in the Watergate complex. However, this burglary involves stolen files from Howard Hughes' holding company, the Summa Corp. The initial police report on the theft said the thieves stole $68,000 in cash, two Wedgwood vases, a ceramic samovar, two butterfly collections, three digital watches, and an antique Mongolian eating bowl, among other things. But it later came clear that they also stole two footlockers of documents, which included detailed information about the Glomar Explorer's top secret mission. This was used in an elaborate blackmail scheme that may or may not have succeeded. Eventually, the word leaked out, in spite of the CIA's best efforts to keep the lid on the story. The Los Angeles Times broke the news with a number of inaccuracies on February 7, 1975, followed by many other follow-ups. When the national stories broke, the CIA came up with an answer to the media storm that ensued. They responded to all media requests by saying they could neither, quote, confirm nor deny the existence of Project Azorian. This response has become known as the Glomar response and has become an almost hackneyed response by government agencies when it comes to media questions they'd rather not discuss. In the end, as best we know, all that engineering and the millions of taxpayer dollars appeared to have been for naught, at least when it came to raising the Soviet sub. The Glomar Explorer did, however, get a new lease on life after being mothballed for two decades by the U.S. Navy. The company that took over the ship had to pay for an expensive and difficult retrofit, especially the electrical system, which, quote, did not go where it was supposed to go, according to a contractor's report. It only went to the CIA's covert control room. Of course. But in 1998, it did sell again, this time refitted as a drill ship, looking for other riches in the deep. Oil. I'm Nancy Basil-Chuck, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. My guest on today's show was Mats Ingolstad. You can find links to many of the documents I used to put together today's episode in the show notes. Writing, editing, production, and sound design by me, Nancy Basil-Chuck. Thanks for listening.